Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening this week. I'm Jared Serbu. On the program this time, we're happy to welcome back Vice Admiral Bill Moran, the Chief of Naval Personnel. We've invited him back on the show because there's a lot going on at the moment with the Navy's personnel system. A lot of changes announced in May by Navy Secretary Ray Mabus, ranging all the way from updates to how sailors' physical fitness is measured, changes to sexual assault prevention programs, to how the Navy approaches talent management and the career progression of military personnel. We'll focus mostly this hour on that talent management aspect of the changes. Some, as you'll hear, will require congressional approval, but the Navy hopes to accomplish most of the changes on its own. I talked with Admiral Moran in his office in Arlington, Virginia, and started the conversation by asking him what's wrong with the personnel system as it is.
It starts really with my history of watching recruiting and retention behaviors in the past 30 years that I think most of us who've been around that long remember some challenging times in the post-Cold War days. And certainly in the late 90s, when I was at XO and CO in the fleet, we were really struggling with our ability to retain the folks that we really wanted to retain. And my recollection of recruiting challenges back then was also very significant. So we weren't getting the highest quality folks, and that's demonstrated in our metrics that we've been able to pull. And we were also arguably, not being able to keep, like I said earlier, the folks that many COs in the fleet wanted to keep in. And when I got in this job 22 months ago, looking around at what we call the health of the force, our recruiting metrics were demonstrating that we were getting the highest quality we've seen in probably the last 30 years, based on high school grad rates, ASVAB scores, all those metrics that we look at. And our retention for zones A, B, and C, and in most of the officer communities, was at what I would describe as historic highs. So we were keeping great folks, and so the health of the forces has been for several years and continues to be extraordinarily good. So my analogy is whatever goes up has to come down. And if we're at historic highs and the economy was at a historic low in 2008, 2009, and it's starting to improve slowly, but arguably surely, then at some point, our ability to attract and retain high quality is going to run up against stiff competition economically. And are we prepared to deal with that? Do we have the tools, the policies, and the personnel system that will allow us to react and respond in time? And the answer is we have precisely what we had 30 years ago in place. So we're more likely than not to repeat our performance in the late 80s and late 90s, which is struggling to meet recruiting goals and struggling to meet retention goals. So when you look at it from that standpoint, that personnel system that's been around conceptually since post-World War II, only modified with things like important things like the all-volunteer force in 73, some Goldwater-Nichols adjustments in 86, DOTMA reform in 80. We fundamentally have the same system that manages our raw material of people in an industrial fashion. And it got all of us here to start to thinking about, could we design a system that is more modern? Should we design a system that's more modern? And what would it look like? And then what kind of policies do we want and authorities do we think we need to deal with potential challenges in recruiting and retention at whatever point it occurs? It could be next year, it could be 10 years from now. And so the answer to that question is, after talking to several corporate leaders in the HR world and talking to a lot of folks that have been around for a while, the answer is absolutely we need to modernize this weapon system we call personnel to reflect a modern, more transparent system that will meet the expectations of the generation of young men and women who are coming into the Navy. So kind of a long answer to your question, but there's a lot behind the question you asked.
There is. Explain that phrase you used a minute ago, managing people in an industrial fashion. What do you mean by that?
Well, for example, we've always brought in lots of people. So for the last 10 years or so, we averaged anywhere between 35 and 40,000 enlisted folks that come through Great Lakes and into the fleet every year. And our structure is to bring in lots of people at the bottom, at only to retain 13 to 15% of those people for a career. So that's a pyramid structure. It's an up or out system. And so that's conveyor belt. You bring them in large numbers and you neck them down over time and hope you get what you need at the end. We have not done a very good job for years about tracking the quality of folks, the quality of that talent that comes through that industrial model. So part of it is just being able to track and assess whether we're keeping the right people. And the answer to that is if we were better able to identify that talent and have ways to incentivize and inspire them to stay, you could argue you don't need as much raw material on the front end. And that raw material on the front end, bringing that the numbers we're bringing in, is a very expensive model. And no corporate business would run it this way. And I'm not trying to say that we're corporate America, but there's a supply chain model here that we could be more efficient in if we truly understood what's coming through the door better and what part of that we try to keep. And as you may know, today when we're looking at retaining in the enlisted force especially, we find a rate and a skill set that we need, or we're concerned about keeping the right numbers. So we send out a SRB message, a bonus message for that rate. And I call it just casting this fishnet out there, reeling it in at some point and seeing what we have. So we always end up getting the numbers we need, but we really don't know whether the ones we pull in are the right quality. We hope they are. And the fact that we've brought in a lot of high quality means that what we generally bring in in that net is pretty good quality. In the future, when it gets harder to recruit that same level of quality, then trying to retain the highest quality out of that is going to get harder. So we need to be more precise and surgical in the incentives to stay than we've had ever in the bonus structure. So one of our initiatives is to try to figure out how to be more individualized, more personalized bonus structures that allow us to target specific talent and specific skill sets, and then drive the number or the amount of raw material that comes in every year down so that we're more efficient. So that is an industrial model versus one that today that's just much more tailorable and agile. And frankly, I think American taxpayers expect that we would be more efficient in how we bring in people and keep people.
But just to be clear, you're not at the point yet where you're ready to make policy decisions that would let you do fewer accessions and keep the same high quality Navy.
No, not at all.
But that's where you want to go.
That's where I want to go. And central to that is modernizing the system that monitors it. And so we have a lot of data in this world we live in, but all that data is not interconnected. It doesn't talk to each other. And so when we try to pull a common picture of where our people are across many, many different characteristics, it's very challenging because we don't have a system that allows that. And so if we want to make precise adjustments to that profile, whatever it is, we can't do it and understand the effect it's having on the rest of the population. So you've got to connect all those databases and put analytic capability on top of it that allows you to make these, you know, I often refer to it as, instead of using the large turn knob and watching the needle swing in big ways, is to use the fine-tune knob, you know, the equalizer, to put it in our generation's terms. You're fine-tuning the bass and the treble as opposed to the volume. Mm-hmm. And so if we can design a system, and we've seen those out there in in corporate America. We know we need something that rides over top all that data we collect in many different forms. And be able to manage our force more precisely.
Let's stick with that information systems piece for a minute, because it's so key to everything that I think you're trying to do, having that information. I know Navy PEO EIS has gone out to industry and said, look, tell us what you can do in order to give us data analytics, as you said, that rides on top of all your existing personnel systems. I assume that's harmonized with what you're working on here.
Yes. CNT. Yeah, we've been closely involved with EIS Mr. Stackley's team down in the Pentagon to try to harvest the good ideas and perhaps even go to some pilot programs to experiment with what industry says they can do to provide us something that we can say, yeah, this is the kind of thing we need to reach into our databases, take that data, correlate it, clean it up, and then provide us good, rich, authentic data. So we have functional databases. So we have a function that we've built a system for, and we have over 70 of these. And they all operate pretty well by themselves. But when you try to do correlation of data and deeper analytics about the total impact and effect on the force, it's a much more difficult challenge. So I'll give you a great example of one. Not too long ago, we were talking about implementation of some family-friendly policies that the secretary really would like to do, and some of those he announced. And a natural question from that would be, well, what's this going to cost? And in order to figure out what's it going to cost, I asked a simple question, or what I thought was a simple question, is how many pregnancies do we have in the United States Navy today? And I got the gulp answer, like, I don't know. Well, how hard can that be, right? We know who's on LIMDU. We know who's probably been seen at an MTF medical treatment facility or outside. The data's got to be there. Yeah, the data's there, but we don't know how to go get it. It took us a couple weeks to get that data, and a lot of hard work by people down in Millington to try to sort through it. And even at the end of that, they're not real sure they captured it all. So that's a simple one you would think would be pretty easy to get, that was very difficult to get. It's an example of multiple, and there's information in multiple pieces multiple silos of those functions that are out there that don't talk to each other. So you can't query a database and get an answer.
Mm-hmm. The pregnancy thing's an interesting example. How much have you thought through the art of the possible as that applies to, you know, talent management through an individual sailor's career? I mean, if you're thinking about a detailer out there as the customer for this data, what sorts of connections could they start to draw that they can't now?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, and one that we've tried to solve, and we have been working on for a few years on billet-based detailing for enlisted, which is basically all the billets in the fleet for enlisted will have a set of discriminators when it comes to the pay grade, the NEC required, the experience level on type model series. All of those things are in each billet in the fleet. And then each individual sailor will have matching categories. And the idea with billet-based detailing is that a detailer can more accurately now match the billet requirements to a sailor or number of sailors in the fleet who could go do that. Today, we it's industrial. We've got people with a rate that kind of fit the requirement in the fleet, and if they're available, we try to do the best we can. But the information for detailers is not readily available on a screen that they can go after. So billet-based detailing is going to help. It becomes the vehicle for a better distribution system. But it could be even better with a common database that both billet-based detailing, order writing, and others are all reaching into that same data and feeding that same database.
That's Vice Admiral Bill Moran, the Chief of Naval Personnel. We'll come back and dig into some of the specific personnel changes the Navy's planning and proposing after a quick break. This is On DoD on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Our guest this week is Vice Admiral Bill Moran, the Chief of Naval Personnel. He's spending the hour with us to discuss some of the changes the Navy's planning or proposing to its personnel system. A whole raft of changes announced just a few weeks ago by Navy Secretary Ray Mabus.
So let's talk about some of the initiatives that Secretary Mabus announced a couple weeks ago.
Sure.
And he made very clear that you're going to need help from Congress on a lot of them. So maybe we should start with the stuff that you can do under your own authority already. Specifically in the area of talent management, let's start there. What are some of the things that you're starting to do administratively already?
Yeah, I think the premise of your question might be a little off.
Okay.
We actually, if you read his remarks and then look at what we've put out, we don't need as much help from Congress. In fact, we need very little help from Congress. Most of it's within our own authorities to actually execute and exercise. We have to develop the policy to support it, though, and we haven't done that. That's what we're in the process of doing. So much of what the Secretary put out there were things that we think we have the authorities to do today. He specifically called out some legislative proposals, though, that we do feel we need some help with. And there are things like reordering the results from promotion boards for officers so that we take the top 10 or 20% of any selection board and we put that top at the top of the lineal. We reorder the lineal numbers so that the very best, according to the board, are the first to be promoted in that year group. As opposed to today, where there is no reordering, you could be the very best of that year group and happen to be the lowest lineal number for selection. You'll be the last one to promote a year after the first in that year group to be promoted. That doesn't sound like managing talent very well. And so that legislative proposal is out there, and we might see that sooner than later. That's one. The SIP, expanded SIP authority is another important one. I think we talked about SIP the last time. That's the Career Intermission Program. The sabbatical, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Very small numbers in authority today. We've asked for expanded authorities, and the Secretary announced we're going to go from 40 to 400 if that legislative proposal is approved. And we're also going to get rid of the restrictions on MSR, which is your minimum service requirement as an officer, which is anywhere from 5 to 8 years, depending on what community you're in. And the restriction on any sailor who's under a critical skills retention bonus is not allowed to apply for SIP. So in my view, that younger group of officers and those critical skilled sailors that we have out there are precisely the folks that we want to give some flexible options to and career choices down the road. So if we get that approval, I think we'll see greater participation rates as a result. And that'll be healthy for the Navy. And then there are a couple other examples of legislative proposals that the Secretary has put out there that essentially get out in terms of managing the officer communities, get at this industrial model in the officer community. I talk about the enlisted, but the officer community is you're tracked by your year group. In other words, when you're commissioned, and there can be some adjustments based on zones along the way, but essentially you can only move as fast as the conveyor belt moves for almost every community. There are a couple of exceptions, but the vast majority of folks, no matter where they are in life, no matter where they are in a career and their milestones, they're going to be in zone when the conveyor belt hits the zone. So what we're trying to do is provide some flexibility in that conveyor belt for people to go off to another conveyor belt and back onto the major conveyor belt at another time and place of their choosing to deal with things like having a family, starting a family, taking care of a sick parent or a sick child, or in some cases it may be a significant opportunity to take and go participate in a graduate education program, which today come in the form of Olmsted scholars, for example, who go off for 2 years, non-observed fitness reports, an incredible opportunity. Yet it becomes very risky for those officers in terms of promotion opportunity because they're not observed for a significant period of time. And so boards, even though we try to give boards the guidance to not penalize folks for having done that, it's very difficult when you're looking at records that look fairly equal, but somebody in there, a top performer, has 2 years of not observed performance. It's hard for a board to say that's worth the risk to select. So the legislative proposal would just give us an authority on the shelf to say, for individual cases, we can reset that lineal number so the person is not disadvantaged for having done something like postgraduate education, a unique opportunity, or needed to take care of a personal issue or family issue or pregnancy or whatever. We give them an opportunity to reset that year group.
So just so I understand, if you go away from the Navy for a little while and then come back, you're now competing against other sailors, not the same group that you were with when you left, but a group that's more comparable to your existing Navy service so far.
Right, so that when your record shows up and you're comparing, it looks comparable in terms of competitive opportunities.
The conveyor belt idea that you talked about a minute ago, it seems to me like one of the consequences of that is not only are you promoting when it's your turn as opposed to when you're ready, but it probably also forces the Navy and the rest of the military services to get rid of a lot of good people simply because there's no room for them immediately at the next rank. Are there ways that you're looking at to maybe allow people to stay in?
Yeah, the first and most important cut to the team is at the 04 promotion board. It's underway right now for the restricted line staff communities. It's the most important one because that sets the course for the rest of your career. Today you get by law you get two looks. If you don't get picked up, we call it FOS, failure to select. It comes with a pretty negative connotation, failure to select. Now, for 05 and 06 and beyond, you are in zone as long as you are beneath your higher tenure requirements. So you get more than one or two looks. You could potentially get looked at several times for those pay grades. Not so with the 04, which is the most important one. So we're looking at maybe a higher tenure-like look for 04 allows you to be in zone when you reach certain milestones, and you can be in zone for a number of years, but until a certain point, if you haven't selected a higher tenure, then we're going to ask you to leave, as opposed to just two looks. That keeps the competition right. It allows people to have potential breaks in their typical career path, or because they were slowed down for whatever reason. I mean, think today about a VFA officer. It takes two and a half years to get through training today for a lot of reasons beyond their control. But their peers in the surface and submarine community have moved through much quicker. So they're getting competitive reports earlier, and they're more competitive reports before the 04 board, which arguably could put the VFA folks at a disadvantage before the board. And so we're watching that very closely. And it showed up last year, as you may recall. Aviation had a more difficult time selecting 04 as a percentage basis. There were many reasons for that, but one of them was just this disparity in the start time for competitive tickets for officers in those communities like VFA, VAQ, and a couple others versus a submarine or surface officer who also, they start their career and their competitive reporting earlier than the rest. And then there's other things we could do around the fringes that are certainly within our authorities today. Today we don't competitively observe ensigns or JGs. And there's a lot of thought to maybe we should, because they are performing. They're performing in training, they're performing in their first tour, and we ought to give them the feedback and start sending the signal to who among these ensigns and JGs are really our top performers, our best talent, and then start to nurture them and move them along. So there are things we can do within our own authorities that don't need congressional action to do it, and that's the focus of our efforts. We'd rather do the things we have the authority to do today, and only ask Congress where we really think we need to help.
Vice Admiral Bill Moran is the Chief of Naval Personnel. We'll come back and talk a bit more about how the changes the Navy's proposing might affect the other military services. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Thanks for listening to federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. And we're back with Vice Admiral Bill Moran, the Chief of Naval Personnel, talking about several of the many personnel changes the Navy announced a few weeks ago. Before the break, Moran told us the Navy can, in most cases, update its approach to talent management on its own. But in some cases, like getting rid of year group management, Congress will need to give the go-ahead.
Last thing on that congressional piece, how in sync with your sister services are you on this? Because it seems to me Congress is probably not going to change the personnel system just for the Navy and leave the legacy system in place for everybody
else. We're pretty fortunate that SecDef has formed up a number of working groups that are working on this very topic. There's three working groups, a military personnel, a civilian personnel, and a technology working group. And you'll see some pretty clear parallels to the things we've been working on for the last 18 months to what those working groups are also working on. So I think that ends up becoming a forcing function to find a common ground between the services and what we've asked for. I've tried to make the point to my counterparts and through the working groups that what we're after is discretionary authority, as opposed to mandating authority, if you follow me, or mandating policy. So give me the authorities that I can put on a shelf and use when I need them as a personnel chief, so that I have more options to deal with circumstances that we need. And that's kind of takes the pressure off everybody feeling like we're forcing people into the same boat. We all operate in different waters, if you will. And we have different needs and different requirements at different times. The Army downsizing needs different authorities than we do right now. And you could argue with the Marine Corps and Air Force are all different. So let's not mandate reform or authorities, but let's make them discretionary in nature so that it gives us more flexibility.
And we've talked before about how the Navy's got a bit more breathing room since you're not in downsizing mode. Are you hoping to kind of, in some ways, be the canary in the coal mine for the other services as you move out on some of these new initiatives?
I'm not hoping to be, but I think we will be. Yeah. And I think most of them recognize that at some point, certainly my counterpart in the Army has a big, big, tough job right now in trying to get at the right number. I don't envy him. But, you know, the Navy went through this last decade. We downsized across the active and reserve force by almost 90,000 sailors. But we had a more graduated approach, and we're allowed that graduated approach. He's on a steeper decline than we were, and that makes it really hard. But I think all the services recognize that at some point, if these are discretionary authorities, they're going to want to have them on the shelf too at some point, because they'll eventually have to deal with the same kind of issues. So far they seem to be very supportive, and I'm encouraged by the dialogue we've had in the working group so far.
Let's spend some more time on this idea of temporary detours from military service, that things like the career intermission program. It seems to me you need to not only create the ability for people to do that, but also create some kind of infrastructure so that there are job opportunities for them to go to. I think you were just out in Silicon Valley to try and lay some of the groundwork for that. How'd that go, and what are you trying to do there?
Yeah, well, the sabbatical program is different from the industry opportunities we're talking about and the grad ed opportunities. They're three distinct things. The SIP or sabbatical can deal with lots of different issues, and it's an unpaid sabbatical. But you can use it for getting a degree, getting an advanced degree, getting a PhD, ghost out of family, like I said, take care of a parent, whatever the circumstances warrant. Or if you have an idea you want to go work in another career field for a year or two and decide and then come back to the Navy, which is a requirement under SIP. It's not free. You get to go to do it for a year to 3 years, but you owe us 2 years for every year on the back end. And there's very little salary that comes with it. You keep your benefits, but you only get 1/15th of a salary because it's a sabbatical. The other programs we're talking about, industry tours, for example, are designed to be a paid option to go into industries where there's benefit to the Navy and the individual. So matching the talent of the individual to a need in the Navy, so that individual can go out and work in an industry, let's say an IT firm or a financial firm or somewhere where a skill set is being learned that can be brought back to bring a different perspective back to the Navy. Go work for a company for a year or two, fully paid, so on and so forth, much like we have with fellows programs today, but expand it a bit more. And then eventually I see this turning into an opportunity for industry to send their best and brightest to the Navy in certain skill set and areas. Think cyber, think financial management, think certainly we do it to some degree in the medical communities today, where folks get to come in, wear the uniform, and be part of the U.S. Navy team for some number of years, and then go back to their home industry. There's a lot of interest in doing this. If we're able to do that, and we match those leaving to those coming in, we don't see a detriment to the manning levels, and we're actually improving. We're improving the diversity of ideas that are going to come back to the Navy through a perspective that's different than how we operate. And we're also bringing the rest of America a little closer, how little it may be as important, a little closer to the United States Navy. And I think that's really important. And the corporations that I've talked to, and I've talked to several, are all very interested in this approach and this concept. So we're working through how we would do it, how would we implement it, execute it, and make it affordable and in a way that benefits the Navy.
How potentially might that work? I mean, I assume a Silicon Valley executive probably doesn't want to come in and go through boot camp and enter as an E2. How would they come in and wear that uniform?
Right.
For
so
a couple
we,
years?
That would be part of how we would negotiate. What kind of person does X company want to send? What level are they at? They could be just a very skilled technician. Let's say in the IT world, somebody who's working for a company out there that's really working on coding, and working on development of software. That might be somebody you bring in as an E6 or an E7 level pay. And we would have to work through what the title would be and what the responsibilities would be, what training would be called for. And I can see a lot of people going, how the heck are you going to do this, right? I mean, but we do it today in the medical community. There's some great examples of people who have been professional surgeons that have come in and been activated in the Navy, worn a uniform of an O4 for 3-4 years. We sent them to combat zones, and they perform brilliantly. And that connection you make to the rest of civilian society to the Navy is huge. Now, where else could we do that? And that's the point. It's not somebody flying an F-18. It's not somebody that drives a submarine as a nuclear-trained engineer. But there are other places, and we're looking hard at where those opportunities might be. And then where our folks could then leave for some number, you know, 1 or 2 years and go into that industry as an exchange, if you will, think of it more as an exchange opportunity, that they get to go see the other side and learn some other perspectives and bring it back later.
From the companies that you've talked to, what do they tell you about the value that they see in sending their people into the Navy for a while?
There's a lot that they see. One of them clearly is leadership. They truly appreciate and recognize that the leadership opportunities that our young men and women get at every level is something that they cannot produce at their companies. And from the ground up. So they're looking at inserting that leadership, those leadership qualities in people that bring a perspective from an organization that knows how to build leaders and insert that and infuse that into their companies. They also recognize that we're really good team players and we like working in a team environment. We're not individuals as much as we are teammates. I think there's a thirst for that in talking to my some of the corporate executives and HR professionals out there. They like what they see from the folks that, the veterans that have been hired in their communities. They're like, these young men and women come in at multiple levels and make an immediate impact on our business. So we like this idea of some exchange tours. So I say leadership, teamwork, and loyalty are things that are values that they really want to continue to build inside their own businesses, because it'll make them better. And they also see the value in having different perspectives. The diversity of thought is as important to them as it is to us.
That's Vice Admiral Bill Moran, the Chief of Naval Personnel. He'll be back with us for one more segment following our final break this hour. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. A few minutes left this hour with Vice Admiral Bill Moran, the Chief of Naval Personnel. We're discussing a series of reforms the Navy's planning to how it manages sailors' careers, including some congressional proposals Navy Secretary Ray Mabus announced in May.
Kind of stepping back a little bit and looking toward the goal of that you kind of outlined at the front end of a flexible personnel system that kind of suits the 21st century. All the changes we've been talking about and everything the Secretary announced a couple weeks ago, is this kind of phase one of a much larger project? Or do you feel like once you accomplish most of this stuff, then we're in good shape?
I wouldn't characterize it as a phase one, and there's multiple phases to the plan. I would say that they're it's the low-hanging fruit that we think we can get and start to implement and execute in the next 3 to 5 years, and some of it we're going to execute tomorrow, literally, and that's all good. So we're trying to do some things that send a strong message to our workforce that we are listening, that we are trying to become more flexible. We are certainly trying to be more transparent to our workforce, and it's an expectation, I think, by the generation of kids that have joined our service over the last 10, 15 years, and that's important. But we also have to do things that will take more time. And there are phases to the IT development that you talked about, that we talked earlier about. We've got to get into the mobile environment in a way that any potential recruit out there, and certainly anybody who's on active duty and reserve today, will look at and say, hey, I'm working for a company that and a service that gets it. And that is modern, and it's an organization that I can get information when I want it, when I need it. And I think that's healthy for us. So we've got a phased approach to that development. I'm not happy, frankly, with the pace, but these things take time. And that's why we're looking to folks in Silicon Valley and other places to help us get there faster in a way that that meets all the requirements that comes with government systems. So that's the biggest challenge, I think, for us.
And in the all hands calls, et cetera, that you've done since a lot of this stuff started being announced, what's the feedback from the fleet been so far as you can tell?
Well, I think the younger petty officers and certainly the junior officers are excited about it. They're very positive. The feedback's been very good. I think the what we call the frozen middle, it's kind of the mid-grade folks are more skeptical, and I welcome that skepticism. We've got to show them that we can do this, that we can execute it, and that it will be done fairly. One thing I think our system has always been, it gets credit for, especially in promotion boards and advancement opportunities, is there's a strong feeling of fairness, but needs to also be tweaked to be more fair, to recognize those who are truly working not just the hardest but the most effectively out there, and are we doing all we can to try to keep them on a team? And so that goes to a lot of the things. And then there is an element of being unfair in terms of the conveyor belt mentality that comes with officer promotions in particular, that while it's a small minority of folks, it's an important minority of folks that sometimes get disadvantaged due to circumstances beyond their control, and others which, frankly, people mature at different points in time. They learn differently, and we ought to have enough flexibility in there to account for that and not count on large numbers of raw material only to get to a much smaller number later on.
Well, last thing in our last couple minutes, you've got all the changes that you're talking about making. It's a lot over the next few years when you combine it with the things Congress is looking at when it comes to compensation reform, retirement reform, healthcare reform. It's a lot of changes to the personnel system sort of all at once. As this goes on, how do you make sure that you're monitoring? Because something will go wrong. I mean, some decision that somebody makes at some point will turn out to have been a mistake. How do you make sure you identify those, pull them out, make sure you can course correct as you go when you notice, you know, attrition happening or insufficient accessions, et cetera?
It's a great question, and it's probably the most important question. And if there's anything I've learned, especially last week out in Silicon Valley, is that there's an expectation out there by leadership for their employees to fail and to fail, as they say, forward. So we fail, we learn, we move on. But key for them is that they are tracking because they're young, and most of those organizations I talk to, companies, are very young. They don't have 239 years of history here in culture and tradition and personnel systems. They're starting kind of from scratch. So they've built in the tracking mechanisms and the surveying into their systems in a way that they can see trends and failure fast, and they can make the adjustments, and they can do the kind of performance evaluation and mentoring to help nurture their workforce better. I think that goes back to IT for us to some degree. And I don't want to lay this all at the footsteps of technology is going to solve our problem, but technology will certainly help us track to see if we're being effective. And again, the data is there. We just are looking for a way to capture the data and then be able to assess the data and make adjustments. So yeah, we're going to fail on some of this stuff. I expect that. What I don't expect is catastrophic failure. And to do it, we're going to have to make sure that we're tracking the right things and that we're seeing it real time. And we can respond to make corrections before it becomes catastrophic. That's by no means to sound alarmist, because I'm excited about this. I think there's a lot that is positive, and that positive energy will turn into good policy and it'll turn into good execution. But we do have to make sure we're collecting the right data and that we're assessing it to see if we've overshot in some areas or undershot in other areas. So it goes back to making sure we modernize our weapon system for people so that we can see the threat coming a lot sooner than we do today.
Well, sir, I wish you the best of luck as you guide the fleet through all these changes. Always appreciate talking to you. Thanks for doing this.
You're welcome.
Vice Admiral Bill Moran is the Chief of Naval Personnel, joining us for the full hour on this week's On DoD to talk about a series of reforms to the Navy's personnel system. You can find our coverage of the changes the Navy first proposed in May at federalnewsradio.com. We'll also post a link to the speech by Navy Secretary Ray Mabus outlining many of the proposals. That's going to do it for our show this week. Thanks, as always, for listening to On DoD. Hope you'll join us again next week. I'm Jared Servio. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.